Bonjour à tous, merci en cette heure du midi d'être avec nous. On a le plaisir d'avoir Richard Morgan avec nous. Alors, peut-être premier préambule, si vous voulez tout comprendre, à moins que vous soyez parfaitement bilingue, il vous faut un petit casque pour pouvoir avoir la traduction en anglais. Et j'ai fait une petite erreur. Voilà, comme ça, Richard, il aura tout en anglais avec nous. On a une heure avec Richard Morgan. Richard Morgan, vous connaissez sans doute Carbone Modifié hein, et toute la série. Là, on va plutôt parler futur, cyberpunk, des thématiques très science-fiction. Mais on va aussi parler de fantasy avec sa série Terre de héros. Je vais y arriver avec notamment le premier tome Rien que l'acier, puis le dernier, Jusqu'à l'âme, vient de paraître chez Bragelonne en 2016, donc c'est tout récent. On parlera aussi de ses romans indépendants, on parlera de ses romans graphiques. Bref, on va parler de tout, Richard, vraiment de tout. On parlera de ses prix aussi. Mais dans un premier temps, moi, ce qui m'intéressait un petit peu, c'est de poser un petit peu la question de comment tout cela, ça lui est venu, en fait. Est-ce que, enfant, vous lisiez beaucoup de science-fiction? Quels étaient vos auteurs préférés? Et puis, comment est-ce que vous avez commencé à écrire?
Is this one? Is this one? Ah, okay. Yeah, I think science fiction was my first love. In that, I read a lot of it when I was young, when I was a child, when I was a teenager. And I kind of always knew that was what I was going to write. I wasn't entirely sure what that would look like until I ran into William Gibson's work in the late 70s in Omni magazine. And that was really... Merci beaucoup. That was really the wake-up call for me, because I reading his short stories, he'd of course blended noir with science fiction, and that really was that was like a drug for me. It was just amazing. And I knew more or less when, I don't know when that was, maybe 78, 79, something like that, I knew this is what I want to write. You know, this is the way I want to write. This is the kind of thing I want to write. And really, from then on, it was just trying. I just kept trying and trying and trying. And yeah, it took 14 years. So.
C'était les thématiques, ce mélange de science-fiction, d'informatique, de monde nouveau aussi, de l'informatique qui apparaissait, qui vous passionnait.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been interested in tech more than anything in the way that tech affects humans, because a lot of the science fiction that I read when I was younger was the old school, guys like Isaac Asimov, and they always, looking back, they always seemed a bit cold, because there was a lot of stuff about technology, about you know, rocket ships and computers and robots and so forth, but it very often missed the human aspect. I felt the human characters felt a bit stiff, a bit unreal. And I think the thing with cyberpunk, and I mean, it wasn't just cyberpunk, but a lot of writers who came after the Golden Age, was they became a lot more interested in the human aspect of the future. And that's really what worked for me, was there's a sort of messy, wet, organic feel to everything, and that, you know, that's, if you want a description of what's human, I mean, messy and wet, that's probably as good a description of human as I can come up with. So that really, that's what worked for me. I think if the only science fiction on offer had been the old school, the science, the Heinlein and the Asimov, I probably wouldn't have lasted. I probably would have moved on to another form, maybe crime fiction or even just general literary fiction. I don't know, because what I was looking for was a human element, and I think it started with the new wave. There are some exponents before, like Alfred Bester, like Paul Anderson, but it was really cyberpunk, I think, that kicked it into gear, because this was an attempt to say, well, let's take the technology, let's imagine what humans as we know them now will do with this. And those futures started to look realistic. They started to look like, you think, yeah, I can imagine this being real, which was not something I ever had with the Asimov and the Golden Age writers.
On recontextualise, hein, on est dans la fin des années 70, 80. Finalement, l'informatique, on en parle en cyberpunk, mais vous n'en aviez pas vraiment l'expérience. Quelle était un petit peu l'ambiance? Il y avait un fantasme sur ces nouvelles technologies?
I don't know. I think all through the 60s and right up until the 60s and 70s, there was a genuine feeling that the future was going to be good. You know, everything would be better than it had been, and technology would solve all our problems, and the human race would sort of ascend to live in some kind of utopian future. And I think around the time of Reagan, Thatcher, and the neoliberal revolution, which is late 70s, early 80s, there was a realization that this wasn't going to happen. That there was an understanding that, yes, the technology was coming, yes, we could do amazing things. Those things were not going to be made available to humanity in general. And that was a real wake-up call for a lot of people, I think, and still is. I think there's still a problem that a lot of us are still wandering around thinking that, you know, the future's going to be fine, when actually the reality is we are the problem. You know, it's humans are the problem. And not just leaders like Thatcher or Reagan, it's the people who facilitated them, because let's remember that both those leaders were elected by very large majorities. So it's something in us, and that's what interests me as a central subject matter, I suppose.
À ce moment-là, vous dites que vous commencez à écrire, vous écrivez tout de suite du cyberpunk et il vous a fallu 14 ans pour être publié. Comment ça s'est fait progressivement?
I started writing cyberpunk quite early on. I mean, in my teens, I was much more of a fantasy fan. I was reading a lot of Michael Moorcock and the sort of traditional sword and sorcery stories. And that stuck, actually. That's never really gone away. I still love those stories. Mid to late teens, I started to get interested in cyberpunk and the tech side of things. And I think I was writing stuff that was cyberpunk inflected, I guess, from age about 18, 19 onwards. And it just took me till 34 to to get someone to take it seriously.
C'est quoi le déclic? C'est souvent une question qu'on pose aux auteurs. Il y a toute la partie où on apprend à écrire, et puis à un moment, ça y est, on est publié. Quel a été le déclic? Comment ça s'est fait pour le premier roman?
It was orgasmic. I think the thing is, I don't really have anyone to blame except myself for a lot of this, because what changed was not, I mean, I got better. Clearly, my writing got better. The kind of thing I was writing when I was 20 was nowhere near as nuanced or strong as the stuff I was writing 10 years later. But also, the zeitgeist changed. And I think the kind of things I wanted to write about weren't really finding favor back in the early 90s. There was less darkness in the zeitgeist. There was less sense that, things could be bad. And I mean, I can remember that early work of mine, short stories, getting rejected because of the fact that the protagonists were unpleasant or unlikable. This was a problem back then. Of course, times moved on, and suddenly this actually became not just acceptable, but actually quite cool. People were starting to like questionable protagonists, unpleasant protagonists. Not that it was a new thing. I mean, this is, you know, the American noir tradition had been doing this in other areas, in other fields, for decades before. But it's like it took a long time for the science fiction genre to wake up to the possibilities of this. So the zeitgeist changed. And I had been advised by a lot of magazine editors who I submitted to. They'd said to me, look, you write well, your writing is good, you have good ideas, but think about changing this, think about changing that, think about modifying this. And I didn't listen to any of this advice. I was very stubborn. I had a clear idea of what I wanted, and I wasn't prepared to change it. And I think as a result, I ended up spending a lot of years not published, because I wasn't shadowing the zeitgeist, if you like. So it was, it was like a sudden, you know, when it was like banging against the door for so long, and suddenly, boom, it opens and you fall in. And of course, the other thing was that most people get published, they keep their day job, they write a book, they write a second book, they write a third book. If they're lucky, maybe three or four books down the line, they can start to think about leaving the day job, becoming a full-time writer. They slowly build their career up. And I missed all of those stages, because I went from not published for 14 years to suddenly major publishing deal, major movie deal, out of Hollywood, which was really what made the difference, because not only because it was a lot of money, but also because the publicity attached to that also helped to sell the book more as well. So, and then it became a virtuous circle, just carried me up. But I went from unpublished to celebrated in about 15 minutes, and which was, as I said, just orgasmic. I mean, I can't describe what that was like. Amazing times.
On arrive à Carbone Modifié, publié en 2003, hein, le premier de la série, thriller cyberpunk. Comment est venue un petit peu l'idée de ce roman?
Yeah, well, again, interestingly enough, the idea for this novel was not science fictional as such. It was, I came out of a drunken argument that I was having with a Buddhist. And the Buddhist in question was talking about the sort of the karmic system, and that you're not punished in an afterlife. What happens is simply that you're sent back in a different form depending on how you've behaved. And his argument was that if you're suffering in this life, it's because in a previous life you did something that was bad, and you are now paying the price for that. And I have a lot of time for Buddhism. I think of all the major religions in the world, it's probably the one that's most attractive to someone who is mentally balanced. It has a kind of sanity to it. But I still couldn't see the justice in this, because it's like, well, okay, if I'm suffering because of acts that I committed, that's fine, but I need to know what those acts were. I need to understand. I mean, you can't have punishment without understanding of the crime. So it's like this business they always say with puppies. You can't punish the puppy the day after he shat on the carpet. You have to take him to where he's shat and rub his nose in it and say, don't do this. And this seemed to me like a really unjust system. It's like, okay, I'm suffering, and that's supposed to be for something I did, but I can't remember what I did. He couldn't answer those questions. He fell back on the same thing most religions always fall back on, was, well, you just have to have faith. So dismissed as a religious argument, if you like, but I found it very interesting. I was fascinated with this concept of, can you be responsible for crimes that you don't remember committing, that you didn't commit in this life? So obviously, when I came to examine that, instead of examining it in a metaphysical way, in a ghost story or a reincarnation narrative, I looked for tech ways of doing that. And of course, science fiction is full of stories of swapping bodies and regenerating yourself, coming back and so forth. All I did really was I got into that car and I hotwired it and I drove it away. And I used that as the vehicle to examine this question of guilt and responsibility. But interestingly enough, it wasn't really a science fictional concept at heart. It was a human philosophical issue, I think.
Oui, puis il y a toute la question, donc dans Carbone Modifié, il y a des enveloppes corporelles, hein, l'humanité, il y a toute une réflexion sur, en fait, où est située notre humanité, puisqu'on peut la télécharger dans différentes enveloppes. Ça découle de cette discussion avec le bouddhiste?
No, not specifically. That, as I say, that's an idea that's been kicking around in science fiction for a very long time. You can go right back to episodes of Star Trek from the early 1960s, where you've got people swapping bodies. So it was an old idea, but again, the more I looked at it, the more I thought it was quite interesting, because it's, well, how much of you is transferred? And in Altered Carbon, for example, the body that the protagonist gets is the body of a smoker. And he himself doesn't smoke, but the body has the habit, it has the nicotine dependency, and so he is forced to smoke. And then the question becomes, right, can I, through the willpower of my actual internal self, can I stop this physical reflex? How much are we physical? How much are we something else? It's one of those questions that the more you think about it, the more it opens itself up to examination. I don't actually have a clear answer to that question, but none of the big questions have clear answers. That's the point, isn't it?
On suit Takeshi Kovacs comme personnage, hein, qu'on va retrouver dans les autres romans. Comment est-ce que vous pourriez nous le présenter, ce personnage qui mène des enquêtes?
Oh, psychopathic burnout, I think. One of the strange things that happened with Altered Carbon was that people really took to Kovac as a hero. And I had people saying to me, you know, he's a great guy, he has a code, he's honorable. And this wasn't the character I'd written at all. I mean, I was writing a man who, on his own admission, is a failure. I mean, he, at one point, someone tells him, success gives you many enemies. And he said, well, that's news to me because I'm a complete failure and I still have lots of enemies. He is, like most of my protagonists, a very dangerous man. And if you're lucky enough to have him on your side, that's fine. But there is always the question of maybe what if he's not on your side? And I think it's very important when you're writing violent heroes not to sanitize the violence, not to believe that in some way, if you're acting in the right cause, somehow the violence is different, that it's acceptable. It's not. It's men of violence are men of violence. And we tend to find that men who've been trained in that form in one way, so for example, the Special Forces soldiers, very often when they leave the military context, they will then go on to become mercenaries in some shape or form, or even criminals, because it's a mode of being that that isn't easy to change. And I think one of the great myths that we tell ourselves, especially through the means of the Hollywood interface, is this idea of the successfully violent hero, the hero who is violent but has it all under control, and when the violence is done, he will just wash his hands and go home to his family and live in a little house with a white picket fence. The evidence is very much against that. That's most human beings can't do that. Most human beings are scarred by the violence, even if they themselves survive it. And that was always important to me right from the beginning. So Kovac is very cool. He's attractive. He's got a lot of qualities that we tend to associate with heroes. But at base, he is a terrifying killing machine. And that's always there. It never goes away. And I, as the books progressed, each book I tried increasingly hard to sort of show you what it feels like to be looking at Kovac through the eyes of someone he doesn't like, rather than, you know, sitting on his shoulder where it's safe.
C'est une question qu'on pose souvent aux auteurs. Je ne sais pas si vous m'entendez. Vous m'entendez ou pas?
Oui.
C'est bon. C'est la traduction marche.
Non.
On va essayer. Hop. Il y a eu un petit changement.
Non.
Yes. C'est bon. Ok. Super. c'est la question en fait du rapport de l'auteur à ses personnages. Vous avez vécu avec ce personnage pendant plusieurs années. Vous lui avez donné un caractère. Vous lui avez donné des actions. Quel regard vous portez sur lui? Quel taux de réalité a-t-il pour vous?
They can be very hard to leave behind. Certainly, Kovac was three books, and when I stopped writing Kovac, I felt a little bit bereft, a little bit as if he died. You know, same thing with the fantasy trilogy. Those characters, I lived with those for three books as well, and it took a long time to write those books because I was doing other things as well. So that was the best part of 10 years living with those characters in my head. It does feel strange when you let them go. And they hang around. They're like ghosts. They never really go away. But yeah, it's all right. You know, it's easier to handle than real people, I think.
Petite question sur le cyberpunk. En tout cas, ça pose souvent des questions sur la technologie. Est-ce qu'on peut voir votre trilogie comme ça, sur un questionnement permanent sur la technologie?
Only really a question on the social systems that govern how technology is used. I think there's a kind of continuing meme. Again, it does tend to come out of the American science fiction factory, especially the movies, that, you know, the Frankenstein myth. And when I say the Frankenstein myth, I don't mean Mary Shelley's Frankenstein myth, because what Mary Shelley was writing about was actually parenthood and the responsibility of looking after the things you create. But what it was turned into by the Hollywood movies in the early part of the 20th century was the idea of science and technology being some kind of monster that we've got to be very careful that we don't set loose on the world. I've never really believed that. I mean, I look around me at the the advances we've made just in the last 50 or 60 years, and I'm very glad to be living now rather than then. I'm very much a technophile in that respect. But yeah, the issue in all my books, I think, all the science fiction books, is this question of, yeah, the tech is great, but who is going to control it? What will it be used for? What access will be provided? And I mean, you know, again, William Gibson, guiding star in so much of my writing, has said, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And that gets it for me. It's, you know, we are in a position where we could very simply abolish hunger worldwide. I mean, we could ensure there was never, ever any cause for anybody to starve in anywhere on the planet. We could do that, but we haven't done it. And the reasons we haven't done it are rooted in who we are as a species, who we are as human beings. So, yeah, that's what interests me. It's the gap between what we could achieve if we were able to organize, to get ourselves organized, and where we fail because we are still very human. That, you know, that gap to me, there's a tragedy in that. There's something inherently tragic in our failure to live up to our potential.
C'est la même, ça me fait rebondir sur le jeu vidéo Syndicate pour lequel vous avez travaillé. C'est un petit peu la même chose. On est dans un univers où on a des syndicats qui contrôlent la population et le mode de vie. Il y a un lien fort entre les deux?
Well, the Syndicate universe wasn't mine. I mean, I was hired to write it, but it already existed, had existed for some years. Again, I think the idea of a world dominated by corporations is a meme. It's something that's quite common and has been for a while now. And again, if you go back through science fiction, you can go right back to the 50s and the Golden Age, and there were some writers who were concerned about this. If you look at guys like Robert Sheckley, for example, or Alfred Bester, they were already starting to detect the shape of the future and to see that it was going to be corporate interests that would dominate, and that the nation state would, if not go extinct, then it would certainly cease to have the same level of relevance. And that has just increased with time. I mean, as we've gone through the 70s and into the 80s with the new wave and then cyberpunk, there's been a conscious reorientation, understanding that that's where real power, because power ultimately is economic rather than political. And so whoever is wielding the economic power ultimately has the political power as well. So Syndicate came out of the same memeplex as my writing did in many ways. And which was one of the reasons, I guess, they hired me to do the storyline, was because they said, oh yeah, this guy, he writes about this stuff, you know, and they brought me in, which was great. It was a real honor. I mean, I had never played the original game, but it was really nice to be headhunted for someone to come and say, would you like to come and work on this game for us? And you know, short answer was, yeah.
Dans le travail d'auteur, est-ce qu'il y a des liens entre le monde du jeu vidéo et lorsque vous écrivez des romans? Est-ce qu'il y a des choses qui vous ont influencé ou qui vous ont aidé par ailleurs?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I've since I got published, two things that I had after I got published that I didn't have before, money and free time. Both of those, I was a teacher before, so both of those were in very short supply for me. I suddenly, one of the things I started doing when I got in 2003, once I was published and free, was to get a game platform and start looking at what the games industry did. And I guess over time, some of the better games that I've played have also fed into my ideas about narrative, about protagonists, the hero narrative, and so forth. Certainly, yeah. I mean, it all feeds in. Ultimately, you're always sucking this stuff in. The movies you see, the games you play, the books you read, the comics you read, even the stuff you pick up from the news. All of that is sort of sucked in and ground up in the machine, and you know, eventually you cough out a book.
Vous parliez de William Gibson. Qu'est-ce qu'il y a de William Gibson dans Carbone Modifié?
I think, okay, things that I owe to Gibson very clearly are the idea of the digital download, because, as I said, that comes from a lot of places in science fiction, but I think Gibson was really the guy who sort of got that up and running in a very defined and recognizable form. So I owe him for that. I owe him for the cityscapes as well. He was, again, someone who very early on spotted what the future skyline was going to look like. and bringing in this influence from the Far East, from Japan, from China, and so forth, and melding that with the Western world. So I owe him for the cityscapes as well, and a certain amount of the kind of the computer hacking, which doesn't play a very large part in most of my books. It's there, but it's a secondary issue. Gibson's early narratives were mostly very non-physical. They were about characters who tended to sort of walk away from the physical. They preferred not to live in the flesh, because they were living in cyberspace or in some other way. That's not me. I mean, I think that's where we're very different writers, in that my stuff has always been intensely physical. My characters are usually very physical, and their role is not to get into a computer system with their mind, but to break people's bones and kill them with their bodies. So in that sense, we diverged quite strongly. But certainly for the ethos, for the tone, I owe Gibson massively on all fronts, along with Ridley Scott for Blade Runner, which, of course, was a massive influence at the same time.
On parle d'une adaptation en série sur Netflix, si j'ai bien lu. Okay. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous faire un petit point là-dessus?
Yeah, I can't tell you very much, because then I'd have to kill you all. it's coming. I was out in Vancouver watching the shoot in February of this year. It transcended my wildest dreams for what I'd hoped could happen. Basically, the person who's developing it, Lita Kalogridis, had originally wanted to develop it as a feature film, but the script that she wrote came in at well over 3 hours. It was a 3-hour, 10-minute movie. And the number of Hollywood directors who can command the budget for a 3-hour Hollywood science fiction movie is, you know, you can count it on the thumbs of one hand. You know, it really is. It's Ridley Scott, maybe. Michael Mann, perhaps, although he doesn't have track record in science fiction, and Nolan, of course. Christopher Nolan was it. So anyway, there's this very short list of directors that she could approach. They were all busy doing other things, so that was it. We were out. We were bust. She tried to bring the script down, but she was very keen to stay faithful to the story, and the script never got shorter than about 2 hours, 40 minutes, which was still too long. And then one day she just comes to me and says, well, all right, look, we can't do this as a feature film. How do you feel about turning it into a movie, into a TV show? And I'm like, yeah, that's 10 hours of exposition. That's exactly what this needs. But what I didn't realize was that she was going to not only get the deal for the 10 episodes, but also get a fantastic deal with Netflix, where they pushed out they've got a budget, I think, of about $12 million per episode. So you are looking basically at feature film budgeting over a 10-hour show. And I say, I was there for the shoot. I saw some of the footage and what they've done, and it is mind-blowing. It is absolutely mind-blowing. I cannot wait until February next year, which I think it's coming in February next year. It's just, yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait.
Quel regard vous avez, parce que c'est votre monde, c'est votre histoire, c'est vous qui l'avez créé, et d'un seul coup, d'autres s'en emparent, il y a des images. Comment est-ce que vous vivez ça en tant qu'auteur?
There's always a twinge, you know, because people who adapt your work are always going to sort of see things you don't, or not see something that you did see, and you so there's always that but the point is you have to let go. I think, you know, that as a wider truth, you have to let go of your book as soon as it's published, because you wrote it, and as long as you're the only person who reads it, then that's fine. It is yours, it belongs to you. As soon as it's out there in the world, everyone has an interpretation, and so you lose control of it then, and people can come to you and say, tell you something about your own work, and you're like, no, that's not it at all. You know, but for them, it is. And you can't do much about that, really. You could sort of think, I maybe didn't make that clear enough in the book, but maybe you did make it clear, and this person just doesn't interpret the world the same way you do. So I think this death of the author meme is a true one. I think you've got to accept that you lose your hold on your work as soon as it goes out there in the world. And when it's adapted for another medium, like a game or a movie or TV show, that's even more the case. You just have to let it go. What you hope is that the person who's adapting it honors the spirit of the work. And certainly that's what I've seen here. I mean, I think this is, say, the reason there were so many stumbling blocks at the movie development stage was because Kalogridis didn't want to compromise on the vision. She wanted a movie that carried the same spirit as the book, and that's why we couldn't get it made. So I'm confident that the spirit of the book is there. Of course, there'll be changes. It isn't going to resemble the book identically, and it wouldn't be a very good show if it did. And yeah, I'm sanguine about that. I think I wrote those books over 10 years ago. In the case of Altered Carbon, over 20 years ago, and they're sort of like children that have grown up, and I'm kind of interested to see what they do out in the world. But I can't be there sort of saying no, don't do that. No, you can't. No, you know, they're not my babies anymore. You just got to let them go and see where that goes. And mostly where that goes is fascinating because it's the interface of your work with a whole bunch of other brains. And say, in the case of adaptation, a whole bunch of other creatives who've sort of got their angle on it.
Je voudrais maintenant qu'on passe à un autre roman en 2008, mais qui est important aussi, c'est Black Man, avec là aussi un futur, là aussi avec une partie de l'humanité modifiée. Est-ce que vous pouvez, pareil, nous dire un petit peu les idées initiales avant d'écrire ce roman?
Yeah, Black Man was a... Basically, Black Man was a reaction to the Kovacs books, because the problem with the Kovacs stories was that because your body, because you can be resleeved, because you can be downloaded as data, kept, saved, put somewhere else, it kind of eliminated the impact of death, or not eliminated, but it was much harder to work with death as a part of the storytelling. So I wanted to write something that didn't have that. So I backed right up and said, right, okay, we're going to have a world in which that technology isn't possible. If you die, you die. And I'd been interested for quite a while in genetic science and where we were going with that. And it strikes me that we kind of, with the really successful franchise, like the X-Men, this idea of genetic modification. But it always struck me as too exaggerated, you know, that you're genetically modified in such a way as your hands catch fire, or you can fly, or they're all things that work fine on a comic book page. But when you look at the actual novelistic logistics, so you want to examine this from a more philosophical point of view, you want to get inside the characters' heads, it's all too explosive and sort of young and dynamic to do that. And also, it's not where we're going. You know, it's going to be very difficult to genetically engineer humans who can fly. Genetically engineer humans who don't suffer from conscience when they kill people, that may be a lot easier. Genetically engineer women so that they think actually they should just stay home, look after the kids and not compete with men. It's dangerously easy to do. These are little tweaks to the gene code that are probably within our grasp now, or certainly within the next 20 years. And that was fascinating to me, because those things, although they're very, very tiny changes, I mean, it's not something dramatic. You won't even see it in most cases. But the impact that it'll have on a society is colossal. We've all watched The Handmaid's Tale, which is an enforced patriarchy, and a metaphor for the patriarchy we actually live in. But what if you could fix it so that those women actually wanted to be handmaids, servants, slaves to male humankind? If you could do that, I mean, then the society that you have becomes nightmarish, but at the same time, it's very clearly recognizable. It's a very small jump. And similarly, the idea, I mean, the protagonist of Black Man is essentially a super soldier, but all that's really been changed is his capacity for violence without suffering remorse or traumatic stress breakdown or any of these things. He's also not very good at, I mean, the reason these super soldiers fail in the book is because they are also not very good at group dynamics. They're very self-oriented. They're not very good at doing what they're told, so they don't make very good soldiers. And yeah, that kind of stuff was much more interesting to me, because the detail is fine, but the impact is colossal. It's the opposite of the X-Men. The X-Men is, you know, the impact is actually quite small, because these people still behave like the standard comic book heroes and bad guys. But you have this colossal change in someone's gene code, but then actually when the way they behave is exactly the same as a decent 16-year-old middle American boy would behave. You know, to me, that's there's something wrong with that. I much prefer to look at it the other way. And yeah, so Black Man's much more near future. It also deals with the breakup of the United States into separate political entities because of the sort of long fissures that have existed. And I mean, since Trump got elected, I've had a lot of people mailing me saying, oh my God, it's exactly like in your book. And you're like, I hope not. No, that's okay. I'm done.
C'est encore une fois une sorte de thriller avec une espèce de course-poursuite, un rythme important, un peu comme dans Carbone modifié. C'est une volonté ou c'était naturellement, à partir du moment où vous mettez de la science-fiction, vous l'écrivez un peu comme un polar ou un thriller?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I went to listen to another author talk a few years ago, a writer called Louise Welsh. I don't know if anyone's heard of her. She's a Scottish thriller writer, a literary thriller writer, but very good work. I recommend her. And someone said to her from the audience, said, oh, I noticed that there's always an immense amount of jeopardy and danger and risk in your books. You know, is that the kind of narrative that you like? And she just looked at this woman. She said, well, doesn't everybody? You know, and that's the thing. I like thrillers. I like fast-moving narratives. One of the reasons I don't read an enormous amount of literary fiction these days is because it tends to feel very staid, very static, very. I don't want to caricature, but dull. It feels like very often these are stories that don't really matter because they're about a middle-aged professor of English at a university suffering from the fact he can't get erections anymore. You know, it's like, I don't much care about that. So for me, it's, chases, violence, car chases, helicopter chases, gun battles, hand-to-hand combat. I love this shit, you know? So inevitably, everything I write is always going to be through that lens because if I was writing something else, I think I'd be bored.
Alors, puisqu'on parle justement de violence, on va dériver sur la série Rien que l'acier. Rien que l'acier, on suit trois personnages qui ont été un peu des héros et qui ne le sont plus aujourd'hui. Uh-huh. Quelle était un petit peu l'envie de départ pour vous?
That was my accidental fantasy trilogy. Yeah. What happened with The Still Remains was that about 10 years ago, I was talking to my editor and I told him that I had these character vignettes of fantasy characters that I'd invented. One of them was a short story I'd written that never got published. A couple of the others were just really opening sequences of a chapter with a character. So, and I said, oh, you know, I could do something with this. Like I said, I always loved Michael Moorcock, Sword and Sorcery, Carl Edward Wagner, this kind of thing. So, and I said, oh, you know, we could do something with this. So he asked to see these vignettes. And he looks at them and he goes, oh, yeah, okay, great. So how many books is this? Yeah. And at the time, one book. Yeah. And he looks at me and there's this kind of moment like in the Godfather movie, you know. How many books is this, Richard? So, and I go, three? He goes, yes, correct. Have a contract. And so there I was. I had a fantasy trilogy to write and no idea where these characters would go or what they would do or anything at all, you know. It was great. It was liberating. But I had no idea what to do, and I just had these characters. So one of the things that I'd always disliked about where fantasy had gone in the 1980s, especially, I think, the sort of late 70s, 80s onwards, the way that we'd ended up with a lot of kind of pastel-shaded fantasy, where, you know, it was very clear good guys and bad guys, the sense that, you know, sort of rising heroes, young protagonists coming into their powers, the whole Star Wars narrative, basically. And this is an interesting thing. I think you are either a Luke Skywalker fan or you're a Han Solo fan. I think, you know, people are one or the other. I was always a Han Solo fan. I could never be bothered with Skywalker. He's like a fucking kid.
I didn't want to be a kid even when I was a kid, you know. So I didn't want a young protagonist, and I didn't want, you know, a call to arms, a heroic deed to be done, an evil to be battled. So I thought, well, okay, instead of starting with a great war, let's go to the end. And so I kind of imagined it as the fourth book of The Lord of the Rings, where the war is won, the evil has been defeated, and now what? Your economies are in ruins because you've had to fight this massive war. You've got totally fucked up war veterans by the thousand coming home. There's no work for them because the economies are in ruins, so what do? You've got marauding bands of sort of semi-civilized mercenaries. You've got tensions, poverty, destruction, disillusionment as well, the sense that... basically, I think what I was trying to do, as well as unpicking the Tolkien vision, which, to be fair, is not as unequivocal. I mean, it was his imitators who came later who sort of cleared out the negatives. Tolkien does have a very melancholic view of what happens after a great war. But also, I wanted to try and unpick the lie we've told ourselves about the Second World War. Because the Second World War stands as the great just war in the sense that you can't look at the Nazis and say, look at it from their point of view. No, I mean, Nazis... It's a very clear evil. It's very easy to say this was a war that had to be fought. What we tend to forget is that the people who fought it were Stalinists, British imperialists, and Americans who enforced segregation and Jim Crow laws on the black population of America. So that gets edited out. And there's also this weird idea that after the Second World War, everything just went back to being roses. You know, we had this war, it devastated the continent, but then we won, everyone went home, it was great. You know, there's no mention of the millions of women raped by the invading armies, there's no mention of the massive devastation to all the cities on the European continent, not just in Germany, but elsewhere as well. There's no sense of the cost at either an individual or a national level. And it's interesting because, I don't know, has anyone seen the movie Fury? That guy. Fury is a war movie with Brad Pitt in it about an American tank towards the end of the Second World War. And one of the things that struck me watching it, I mean, it's great, I really enjoyed it, but one of the things that struck me was it's taken until now, and we're talking about 3 years ago, this movie, something like that, it's taken until now to write a Second World War movie in which the war is genuinely portrayed as horrific and hellish. Because all through the movie, you're looking at this thinking, Christ, you can't take it. You cannot take the levels of depravity, brutality, slaughter, and general mess. And these are the good guys. These are the guys who are winning the war. All through the movie, my thought was, Christ, and this is what it feels like to be winning this war. What was it like to be on the others, to be on the losing side of this? But it's taken until now. I don't think there's a single Second World War movie that I can bring to mind prior to this that makes any attempt to address that. You know, in that sense, it's a Hallmark movie. You ought to see it because of that, because I honestly can't. Saving Private Ryan, yeah, the first 15 minutes maybe. After that, it goes back to being a standard Hollywood hero narrative. So I think part of what I was doing with this was to try to unpick that as well, this idea that you can have a great war against a great evil, which the Nazis were, but it doesn't cost anything. You know, once it's done, we just go, oh, God, glad that's over, and everyone goes back to living this nice life. And clearly that's just wasn't the case. You know, the scars were immense. They lasted for years and decades. And I wanted that. I wanted that as my fantasy milieu, you know. The mess after the war, Great War. So that's not much in terms of story, is it? But that's what I set out with, and I just basically plotted a narrative that would have these heroes thrown together, and there's a new problem, and they get on and try and solve it. And then it kind of meandered around. But yeah, I think that was my agenda. I had an agenda rather than a narrative.
Sur les trois héros, on a un héros homosexuel, on a une héroïne métisse. Est-ce que ça a provoqué pas mal de discussions? Est-ce que vous aviez conscience un peu de bouger ou l'envie de bouger un certain classicisme en fantasy?
Well,
Yes and no. I mean, not that much, I think, is my main answer, because one of the things I find about most high fantasy is how unbelievably gay it is. I mean, it is camp. It is these big, muscly men with big swords. I mean, you know, the symbology of it couldn't be more obvious. It's extremely homoerotic. You know, and there is a very strong camp element running through high fantasy, which I embrace. I think that's great, but it's kind of hidden. It can't come out and actually admit what it is. So when I created Ringil, who was the male homosexual protagonist, it wasn't. You know, once I put him on the page and I hadn't decided about his sexuality at all, but as soon as I decided that he was gay, it suddenly made all sorts of sense. It was like, yes, absolutely. This makes perfect sense. He fits this, you know. And obviously making him homosexual also gave me the opportunity to give him an outsider status. You see, it's in a fantasy universe, my problem was heroes tend to be from the nobility, mostly. I don't buy this kind of heroes rising up from the peasant class, because in my experience that just doesn't happen. Generally peasants don't get to do anything very much, because it's a static, rigid society. It's very, very, very hard to succeed move up socially. So your heroes, your swordsmen, are likely to be aristocrats, because this is what aristocrats do for a living in this milieu. You train for war. It's all you do. You grow. If you're a king or a prince, you grow up learning the art of war. While everyone else is working in the fields, making the food to feed your family, your whole job is to be prepared for war. So the problem with that is, if you have these guys, and that's where they're from, that's their background, that they're aristocrats, basically, they aren't really going to be outsiders. They're not going to have a problem with it. It's like, yeah, well, this is the way things are supposed to be. God has said that this is the way it should be, or the gods have said that it's the way it should be. Fine by me, you know. And if you look at something like, I don't know if any of you guys have seen Vikings, for example, the History Channel show Vikings. One of the great things about that is it makes no attempt to apologize for the Vikings. It just says, look, this is what they're like. Get used to it. So my problem was, I wanted an outsider character. I wanted somebody who, you know, could see the evil inherent in the system. If he's an aristocrat, why is he going to see that? It seems unlikely. So by making him gay, he's immediately an outcast, because that his sexuality, which is not something he can change, is the thing that defines him, and it's a thing that defines him against the society that he belongs to. So that also fitted really, really well. And when I saw how well it fitted, when I got to Arketh, the female protagonist, thought, okay, so we make her gay as well, because this just works. It was more organic than that, to be honest. I mean, the opening scenes for those two characters, they became gay over the course of the scene. It wasn't forced. It wasn't something I wanted from the start. It just emerged on the page. In the case of Ringil, he's living in obscurity, and I wanted a kind of grubby feel to this, a sense of marginalization. And I had the idea of him, you know, fucking the serving girls. And it's like, well, to be honest, in that milieu, fucking the serving girls would be something that any aristocratic male with red blood would consider perfectly normal. They're peasants. Who cares? You know? So I needed to find a way in which this would be unacceptable to his family, to his friends. So then you say, okay, he's fucking the stable boys. Bingo. And you're off. Similarly with Arketh, the lesbian element to her character emerged as a part of the first scene, because she meets with the emperor has a slave girl, and she identifies with the slave girl against the emperor, and so the sexuality emerged from that. So it was organic. It wasn't a choice that I made out of a determination to change things. But I think once the choices were made, I just realized how obviously fitting it was. And as I say, I still maintain that most of the well-known epic fantasy heroes are gay in all but name. I mean, Conan is a gay icon, there's no question about that. And I mean, the guys who made Conan the Barbarian with Schwarzenegger, I mean, the director, I believe, was gay. There was an enormous sort of camp element to that whole thing. And then you look at Moorcock, and you look at characters like Elric, for example, who is an albino, and he sort of drifts around draped in long robes and things, and he's very languid and mannered, and he's very, again, very much a sort of a stereotypical Oscar Wilde type character, you know, in that sense. So it seems to me that these tropes are already there. It's just no one wants to admit to them. And I think part of the reason I encountered some flack was because I kind of took the cover back and said, actually, let's just do it for real. Let's not pretend anymore. Yeah, and there was an interesting reaction to it.
Le temps file, il est déjà 13h53, j'avais encore plein de questions, mais la parole est à vous. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question à poser à Richard Morgan?
Come on.
Non, ne soyez pas timide.
Don't be shy.
Bon, bah, moi j'en ai encore une, j'en ai encore plein. Vous avez reçu plusieurs prix, notamment pour Black Man. Quelle importance les prix ont dans votre carrière d'auteur ou dans votre travail d'auteur?
It's always nice to get prizes. They don't pay as well as the big literary prizes, of course. But let's put it this way: would I trade my awards for Dan Brown level of sales? Yes, I would. You know, in the end, I'm doing this for a living, and I need to make a living. So I would. I think, in a sense, I think there is a balance, because very often the books that do sell the most, because they have a kind of very populist feel to them, if you like, very often they're the ones that don't win awards, because they don't maybe go into the places that the people who give awards are looking for. They're maybe looking for nuances and subtlety that don't show up in books that are very, very popular. And that's fine, I think. So the awards are a kind of consolation prize, you know, that you're not selling a million copies of your book, but, you know, you did win the Arthur C. Clarke Award, so there's that, you know. I think detaching from the personal, I think awards are very important, because they reward excellence detached from sales. And that's very important, because I think a lot of the best books ever written have not sold that well, especially not at the time that the author was alive. I mean, sometimes they become bestsellers after the guy dies. It's not much use to him, but to the rest of us, it's great. So I think awards are very important, whether I win them or not. It's nice when I win them, but it's important that somebody wins them, because it's a form of evaluation that doesn't purely depend on the bottom line. And I think that is very important. When I worked in the games industry, one of the things I liked about the Electronic Arts was that their decision on whether to continue with a game franchise, to make a second game, it was governed by two factors. One factor, obviously, was sales, had they sold a lot of copies of the game. But the other factor was the Metacritic rating. Had the game received good reviews? And if the game had received very good reviews on Metacritic, but hadn't sold all that well, then they would take that under consideration. They might make the game anyway. I mean, that's how you got Mirror's Edge 2, for example. So I think there is a role, that there's a part to be played by awards. It's not the gratification of an individual author like me, although that is nice. It is to set up the idea, the sense, that there is more to art than popular appeal. Popular appeal is great, but the reward is you sell a lot of books, and you make a lot of money. It's good that there's another channel that says, all right, this hasn't sold all that well. It doesn't matter. We feel that it deals with certain themes in a way that is exemplary, excellent, something we don't see very much of. And I think that is important. I don't think any field of art can continue without having that channel as well, because that drives excellence in a way that, if not, it doesn't exactly ignore, but it certainly pushes aside the issue of the bottom line. And I think we all understand that. I mean, a lot of publishers I know, a lot of movie makers I know, they're very much about, we will make the popular stuff because that gives us resources with which to make the stuff that may not be as popular, but we will be proud of having made it. My publisher, Malcolm Edwards, once, when I was talking to him about a set of short stories by somebody, I forget who it was now, but anyway, they weren't selling, they weren't, these short stories that hadn't sold very well in their original form, and we're talking about a British edition, and I said, oh, I know they're not going to make any real money. And he said, oh, I think, you know, as long as the general list is in good health, there's no harm in publishing one or two books that are commercial suicide. And I think
that, you know, that's an understanding that runs through all people who work in the arts, I think. The idea that, yeah, you've got to make money, because without money the thing collapses. But part of the idea is that you make that money so you can also support things that are simply good art, whether they sell or not. Things that you can look back and say, I am proud to have been a part of that. You know, and that's, without that, art just withers and dies. And you end up with porn.
Une reconversion. Un dernier mot sur qu'est-ce que vous écrivez actuellement, quels sont vos projets?
Yeah, I'm finishing up a long-awaited science fiction novel. This has taken a long time to write, mainly because of a lot of changes going on in my life. I became a father late in life. I've had a major move from one end of the country to the other, been various other things going on as well, plus being involved in the Netflix production, being involved in various other things. But anyway, it is nearly done. I have about two or three chapters left to write, hopefully be delivering it this month. It's called Thin Air. It's a sequel of sorts to Black Man. It takes place in the same universe, albeit on another planet and 100 or more years after the event. And it's my first attempt for a while to write something that is just good fun. I'm not so concerned about the themes and so forth. They've come out and my usual obsessions are there, as they always tend to be. But mostly this is just to have some good cyberpunk noir, future noir fun. And say I'm hopefully done with that within a few weeks.
Il nous reste à le remercier. Vous allez pouvoir le retrouver tout de suite en dédicace. Merci à tous et merci à Richard Morgan.
Merci.